Welcome to Trashy Divorces in kind of a special, grittier, cozier way than normal.
In an REM kind of way.
REM, jangly.
Our song this week, Driver 8, early REM, released in 1985, originally on Fables of the Reconstruction. Y'all, I'm a Georgia gal. And REM, they are just like a lullaby. Old REM is my favorite. This one hit my ears this week with the, we can reach our destination and we're still a ways away. So that's the episode title this week.
Yes, what Alicia is alluding to is that we have our live show tonight, and we realized that planning out four stories in 1 week was really not going to work for us.
So, yeah, it was kind of a lot.
So please send us a good thought about our live show tonight if you're listening on Sunday.
Yeah, wish us some leg breaks.
And leg breaks, right. Let's not have any. I have had so many problems.
So many breaky things.
My arm is working again.
Maybe just hold a good thought and send us some luck. That would be great.
We would love that. Thank you.
So this weekend, trying to create a little bit of balance, we wanted to actually show off a little bit of what we're doing on Patreon. There's a shit ton of stuff going on over there. And we are so grateful to all of our Patreon folks who have joined us. We have the just nicest, weirdest, most amazing, awesomest community over there. And kind of wanted to share it with the world.
So you may have heard on our episodes about the kind of stuff that we post over there on Patreon, but maybe haven't gotten a chance, because some of it's public, and so maybe you haven't gotten a chance to check it out. This is your chance to check it out.
If you've ever wondered if Patreon is worth supporting, play on. This is the episode for you. If you are already a person who thinks our regular episodes might just be a little bit too gabby, this is probably not the episode for you. Patreon is cozier. It's a little bit more informal. Do yourself a favor and just turn this episode off now. Might not be for you, unless you really like history and conspiracies, and then it might be the episode for you. Play on. This is Patreon, y'all. It's loose. It's very cozy. This is our dinner party salon. We're your aunts gossiping with you about the other side of the story.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Pure, unadulterated trash candy.
So, Stacey, what are you bringing to the table this week from Patreon? This was such a fun story you did.
Yeah, so we covered Princess Margaret a while. You covered Princess Margaret back. And one of the outgrowths of that is this very strange and still mysterious.
It was very mysterious.
Bank heist, the Baker Street robbery in London in 1971, where a bunch of two-bit criminals broke into the vault at Lloyd's of London Bank and stole £40 million worth of, we're not even sure, because it was safe deposit boxes, and people didn't come forward to make claims about what they had lost because it was private stuff. I don't know. There are all sorts of hints and rumors and allegations about high profile people in England being involved in very shady stuff, government people. MI5 is somehow implicated. It is a bonzo story.
So get out your tinfoil hats for that one. It is a super fun ride.
Yeah. What do you have? What do you have for
so
the people?
Good. The episode comes from our Trashy Tudor series. It has everything. Today we're covering Eleanor of Aquitaine.
We had so many requests for her too. So
12th century badass. Here's a rundown on the highlights. If you have a Trashy Divorces bingo card out there that you're keeping track of, we have a tiny princess with baby hands and tiny fingers for marriage. Oh, power grabs, alliances, two husbands that were kings of Europe. We have troubadours. We have mother-in-laws. Also, super fun, the reason prenups are a thing. And to round it all out, because everything is rounded out better with a little West Wing.
There you go. Yeah, we've been time hopping all around in Alicia's Trashy Tudor series over on Patreon. And this is an episode that aired back in May and builds to an episode that you recorded this week.
Just this week, about Empress Matilda. We're going to have more on her in just a second.
Sure.
We have a lot of names for our magic mirror this week.
We
who
do.
Who joined us on Patreon this week?
Plenty of people. And thank you all so much
for joining us on Patreon.
Thank you to Justy L, Elizabeth H, Debbie W, Emily M, Andrea M,
Emily P, Krista D, Blair H, Melanie A, Stacy L,
Kylie L, Eileen S, Brittany M, Jillian B, Grace,
Jenny G, Emily C, Cynthia C, Stephanie S, Kimberly P, and Carolyn S.
Thank you all.
Thank y'all so much for supporting us over there. What did our Patreons get this week?
Do a quick rundown. You guys had so many opinions about Blake and Miranda. Woo! So we had to dig into that over there for sure. And we also did a little Mystery Science Theater 3000 kind of thing, watching the death of Blake Shelton's first marriage.
And the duet that Blake and Miranda did to You're the Reason God Made Oklahoma. That was on Trashy Tidbits for Tuesday. What did we do Thursday? Oh, yeah. We did the kitchen sink of an episode. We brought you the news of the Foxhole, Katie Holmes and Jamie Foxx breakup.
Foxhole down, Foxhole down. Foxhole down. Very sad.
More dish on Bearskin Burt and Lonnie Anderson. And a little women supporting women's story that involved Amy Sherman Palladino.
Gilmore Girls. And Mrs. Maisel.
Bunheads, too. Mm-hmm. Who... sticking up for one of our past Trashy Divorces profilees, Kathy Griffin. So that was pretty cool.
All right. And you do this trash astrology thing over there, too. So happy birthday to Virgos.
Virgos. We are so excited for your big astrological month. Thank you for organizing our worlds. We did your Virgo profile that came out also on Patreon this week with Trashtrology. And y'all, Trashy Tutors. Mm. This week's episode covered Empress Matilda, who had the nerve in the 12th century to try to claim power in her own right, and by the instructions left by her dad, the king. The nerve of this gal trying to be king of England.
Lady King. Who ever heard of such a thing?
In the Eleanor of Aquitaine story you're going to hear today, you're going to hear a little bit about Matilda as the mother-in-law from hell. However, the story that we published on Patreon this week gives a little bit more story and context on the life and times of Empress Matilda. Super good. Oh, we had one other fun thing happen on Saturday. We did release something really special. If you've ever wondered what it's like to get a psychic reading, to get a tarot card reading, we had our good friend Margot D. from Book Versus Movie and Fit Bottom Girl. She's a podcast superstar. What a creep. Best Neighbors Pod, who was our brave soul this week and opened herself up to record a tarot reading with one of my very favorite people in the world, a lady named Wanda Callahan from AtlantaPsychicReadings.com. She provided a tarot reading for Margot. So if you ever wanted to know like what that sounds like, you can get in behind the scenes over there and take a gander and a listen. It was pretty fun. We had a lot of fun on Patreon this week.
There's a lot going on Patreon this week. Please enjoy this episode. We will be back with regularly scheduled Trashy Divorces next week.
Oh, I got some super fun trash candy coming for you next week.
Cool.
Thanks, everybody, for tuning in. Stacey, you ready to take a break and listen to some Trashy Divorces this week?
Yep. Let's go, go, go.
Do it.
So, Alicia, you have a pre-tutor, trashy tutor, by popular demand, English history deep cut.
I have a treat for you today.
A treat.
Is what I have.
A treat.
I have a tasty, tasty pre-tutor treat.
Trashy treat.
Oh, it's so trashy. All right, it's good. We have been doing within Trashy Divorces, at least, a lot of recent stories lately. Mm-hmm. And that's cool.
It is cool.
But you know how I feel about this. It's all a spiderweb. And history really does, I think, both repeat and rhyme. So today, we're going to time hop it back to the 12th century. And y'all, it's an exciting story. People say history can't be fun. That is poppycock and balderdash.
Both.
Both. Today, I have the pleasure of telling you about one of the most powerful women of the 12th century. No, the most powerful woman of the 12th century, one of the most powerful figures in the 12th century, wild ride of a life, Eleanor of Aquitaine. Oh, it's so good. This does predate the Tudors.
Yeah.
So our best guess is that she was born in 1124.
Okay.
Maybe 1122. There's some contention, but we'll talk about it in a second. So, why do we talk about her? A, everybody wants to hear about her.
We have received a lot of
So for all of contact. Y'all who are like, come on, get hip to the kids and do Eleanor of Aquitaine.
That's exactly.
I got you.
Hey, millennials. We got the story you really want to hear. I don't know.
Oh, you do want to hear it. No, they have an idea. I don't know
the ages of the people who emailed us. That's all I'm joking about here.
You may want to just take your socks off before they get knocked off.
I'm not wearing any. My feet are going commando. Got my slippers on. You're not the boss of my toes.
So this does predate the Tudors. And we're going to be doing a little bit in the next episode as well that predates the Tudors, but I think in order to truly understand the Tudors, you need to know again what has come before. History does repeat. History does rhyme. It's got a sick beat and I can bug out to it. Okay, so Eleanor of Aquitaine. Let's just go ahead and say 1124.
Sure.
She's born in Poitiers.
That's in France.
And this area at the time is the center of all courtly things happening in Europe. It is chivalry and troubadours and courtly love, and it is the epicenter of that body lush court life that you think about.
Okay.
Thank you, Kat, for jumping on the table.
We now have a podcast for our podcast.
Okay, so here's the thing. I'm assuming Eleanor was a charming, bubbly, amazing little creature. You're going to love this story because there's no astrology for me to talk about because women were not important of their own historical record until they got married. So I'm convinced that Eleanor is a fire sign just by the way her life rolls out.
Sure.
Although we don't know anything about her looks or her date of birth or her hair color or her eye color because, again, she doesn't really exist until it's time for her to get married. It is shameful.
I mean, are there paintings of her, though, that survive?
The only survivable thing from her is her effigy, where she is painted in death.
Mm-hmm.
But the interesting thing about that is she's holding a book in her hands.
Hmm.
Like, we don't know about her education, but... like,
but she could read. She's literate.
We would assume so. Like, for that to be... that doesn't happen.
Right.
That women hold... kings hold swords. But women... So I tend to think that she might have been a little scholarly. Probably a little controversial, because, you know, women in medieval times don't read. So she is going to have 80 years of a life at a time when women had zero agency. 80 years.
Yeah,
I know, I saw your...
nice old age. Nice ripe age.
Don't even want to have on socks. So she is going to find some agency in the 80 years of her life. It's going to be good. It's going to be bad. It's going to be good and bad again. It is the Wheel of Fortune on hype.
Right.
Okay. When Eleanor is born, the thing you need to know about 1124 France is that it is very much divided into territories and factions. So her family is super powerful. They essentially are in charge of the entire bottom left-hand corner of France.
Okay.
They've got wine, river trades, they're wealthy, they rule a lot of territory, there's a lot of feuding sublords.
Okay.
But a lot of territory. Natural resources are good. They
have ports. So her family is, you know, House Stark in the north. Like all of the sublords like answer to them. Is that
correct? Her dad is William the Tenth. He's the king.
Okay. Okay.
So she's a princess of Aquitaine. Her dad, William the Tenth, is
the
king.
So at this point, we don't have a unified France where...
We have a unified France in that William the Tenth holds the power over a bunch of sublords.
Okay.
He's the same as England. It's
king in the north. King in the north.
King of the southern France. Okay. Eleanor's granddad, here's a neat thing about him, William the Ninth. You're going to like this. He is history's first recorded troubadour poet.
Oh, I thought you were going to say vinegar maker because that's... No, but that region of France, like they make the great wines and when they spoil, they make the great vinegar.
Well, see? Spider webs. All right.
The Orleans method is the traditional way of making vinegar. It's known worldwide as the Orleans method.
extra, extra, the trashy divorces of vinegar is coming on Stacey's next bonus story. You're so funny. Her granddad.
Yeah.
First troubadour poet.
Troubadour poet.
Introduces this culture of song and sex and pleasure. Her dad, William the Tenth, the king, isn't quite as
flamboyant
as all of this, but that's okay. Eleanor's mom dies when she's like six. Eleanor has a baby sister. Dad, William the Tenth, is just kind of doing it, but he has no sons. So now, dead wife, no sons.
Right.
Eleanor becomes a much bigger part of the political picture for dad, because mm-hmm. girls can't rule in their own right.
Right, but they can be married for alliances.
So when Eleanor is 13, 15, depending on what year you think she's born, she's young.
Okay.
She's a middle schooler.
Right.
In 1137, her dad dies, and he knows he's going to die. Like, it's coming, and he knows he's leaving two daughters, and Eleanor's the heiress, but she can't rule on her own. So he...
So Aquitaine is an independent, you know, principality or whatever.
Yeah.
Would simply see, like, whoever her husband became would become the ruler. That's so fascinating. Okay.
So he saddles on up to Louis the Sixth of France, which is the territory in the north. Mm-hmm. And he's like, all right,
heading
I guess we should.
Gay Paris.
Right. Go ahead and do it. And Louis the Sixth is like, oui, oui.
I would love this land.
Bonjour. Right.
Wine is tasty. But
William's dying and he's okay.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
I
guess I'm being a little glib.
Okay.
Also, like.
So at 13, Eleanor is now marrying the heir to the French throne, Louis the Seventh. They're married in Bordeaux. So they're married in the south, which is unusual because typically all weddings take place in Paris. But Louis comes down to Bordeaux with an entourage. They get married. They are an hour done with that wedding, where the news comes in that Louis the Sixth has kicked it.
What?
And now Louis the Seventh is king of France.
Wait, so she's been married an hour when she's suddenly the queen of France?
Yep.
At the age of 13 or 15?
Yep.
Oh my God.
Yep.
Okay.
So she doesn't even have time to, we haven't even fucked yet, dude. Like, it's crazy pants, and it's an arranged marriage, and of course she's going to do it dutifully.
Sure.
But now she's the queen of France. They head on back to Paris. Louis the Seventh, Eleanor will describe as more of a monk than a man. He's kind of mild and kind of meek. And oh, let me mention her mother-in-law, Adelaide. Adelaide is now the Dowager Queen of France, and she has absolutely not one sliver of intention of retiring, which Dowager Queens normally do.
Right.
And did I mention that she hates her new daughter-in-law?
No.
So, yay. Eleanor does not have a lot of luck with mother-in-laws in her life, as we'll find out. So Eleanor has all this land and a lot of money, but it's all now signed over to Louis the Sixth.
Right,
so
right.
She has zero control and agency over the power that she has brought to this. But one job of her being an heiress marrying into another noble family is done, and she sure has taken the fast track to queen. But she has one more job to do as queen.
What is that?
Any guesses?
Have a baby boy.
That's exactly right.
Spawn.
She does have spawn.
Produce spawn.
It takes 8 years.
Well, that's okay, though. That puts her at the ripe old age of like 22.
Takes 8 years. And she delivers a very healthy, happy, amazing baby.
Girl.
You got it.
Ah, damn it. Don't these women learn?
In 1149, Louis the Seventh and Eleanor decide that having a baby was so much fun. Let's go ahead and do some other stupid things. Sorry, that's not having children is not stupid, but what they're about to do now is super stupid.
Okay.
They decide to join the Crusades.
Oh, boy.
So they are going to represent the Christian West. Wait, battling.
The king and queen of France are personally going to hop off to...
Yeah.
The Holy Lands
fight. Yep. Horses.
Wow.
The whole nine. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Different times, man.
Fight the Muslim East for control of Jerusalem and the Holy Land.
Sure.
Y'all.
We've got thunder in the background. That's what that sound is.
It is thunder in the background. Sorry, y'all.
Stormy Sunday.
The Tudor gods are mad. Why are you not talking about us, yo? 12th century bullshit. Okay, so hold on. They're off on crusades. Like, this is the real deal flags, ponies, traveling across multiple countries that are not yours.
Right.
Dangerous crusades. They don't go all that great. And in this time, they travel back to Poitiers, her homeland, and stay a little while. And this is where Eleanor's handsome, cool uncle lives. It's his land. His name is Raymond. And pretty soon, all of Europe is talking about the affair that Eleanor is having with Raymond.
Yikes.
And that, oh yeah, they're getting it on. But I don't think that this is the case. I think this is Katie Holmes' call your dad, but calling your uncle instead. And let me tell you why. See, you can't marry anybody in Europe at that time within 7 degrees of affinity. It's the 7 degrees of consanguinity.
Okay.
At least according to the church. But that rule is broken all routinely. The fucking time for old men to marry young girls that they're related to with a lot of inherited wealth and land.
Right.
Right.
And I'm sure the higher up the nobility scale you go, the less
that rule fucking matters. Yeah. Okay.
As with all rules.
That's it. So Eleanor's like, hey, before we take back off on this crusade, Raymond, maybe you need to know that Louis and I are super related and I hate him. And it's against the laws of the church. And maybe if you help me, we can get an annulment. Like never before has a woman tried to pull this stunt. And it won't be the last time, Eleanor, a woman of her own agency, will pull something like this. But hold on. So Raymond, let's have a little talk about him on the flip. He sees his brother, William the X, did not quite leave him the land or power that he thought he so richly deserved from his brother. So by helping Eleanor, he gets to make a power play too with her that, yep, if I help you do this and you get to this next stage, this is how I get what I want.
Well, and so would the lands that had been signed over to Louis revert back to her family?
Put a post-it note on that question.
All right.
Okay. So these two reasons that I've provided.
Some motivated thinking here is what I'm getting.
Power. This is long-term chess. This is classic. We're thinking 8 moves out with 4 different courses. Like this is, gosh, she's fucking genius. Okay. So those two reasons, her wanting to GTFO out of the marriage and finding a legal way that it can be done, and Raymond knowing the power he would recoup, make a lot more sense to me than I'm fucking my uncle.
Yeah.
But people are gossipy little shits. So
that's what our podcast is about.
Welcome to Trashy Divorces. So there are power plays on both parts. And at this time, Eleanor's not successful, but she pretty much gets clamped down and saddled on back to France, where she hangs out till 1151, has another daughter. Eleanor has a little bit more time to increase her resentment levels for Louis, who cannot do anything right, and make a new plan, which she does. Okay.
Okay.
So that's happening there. Meanwhile, over in England, there's a bucky new king, young, handsome Henry II. And in 1152, he shuffles on over to Paris for some peace talks to try to work out England's relationship with France now that his dad, Henry I, has bid it.
Have they been fighting over Calais for a million years at this point?
Since the dawn of time.
Yeah,
I mean, yeah, like they're fighting. They're going to continue to fight over the same lands for the next
hundreds of years.
Okay. Kay. So Henry comes over to negotiate in these Paris peace talks. And Eleanor is still working her plan. Mighty taken by Henry II.
Young dashing Henry.
Young bucky Henry II. And by March of 52, she has her annulment. So, like, this is... Hold on.
That is the king of France's marriage was annulled by the church.
Hold the fuck up. You don't even know. This is the best annulment that has ever happened in the history of annulments that we are going to see from now to the end of this series. Because not only, this is why no other annulment is ever going to be this good, because of Eleanor of Aquitaine. So, not only is her marriage to Louis dissolved very easily this time, because he wants to get the fuck out too. So where he contested it a few years ago and it was in no way possible,
right?
It now is possible because he's like, done with her.
I actually don't like you either.
Okay. Next, their two daughters remain legitimate because the marriage was made in good faith.
Wow.
And, oh yeah, I guess I can give you back your titles and lands too that are yours by your birthright. So
this really is best of all the worlds. Her kids are protected.
This will never happen. Welcome to prenups. This will never happen in the history of the world ever again that anybody makes out this good. Because plan part one, successful. Plan part two, underway. 8 weeks and 2 days after the annulment is granted, 28-year-old Eleanor of Aquitaine has married a 19-year-old Henry II, and now Eleanor is Queen of fucking England. I told you! What?
So, wait, this is 52?
This is 1152.
And she married in 37. So she was the Queen of France for a long time, for a decade and a half.
Queen of France for 15 years, and now she had an 8-week break, shake it off, went to Cabo, you know. Shook that man right out of her hair.
Enjoyed some wine.
And 2 months later, she is now Queen of England.
Good God.
What the fuck?
That is so improbable. Okay,
so hold on. Mm-hmm. What this does is shifts the entire European balance of power to England.
Oh, because she's got all this
lands and titles are now Henry II's lands and titles. So France just got bitch slapped by England and has now become the largest power player land-wise in Europe, and half of France is now under control of the English, and they've never had a battle.
Oh my God.
Like, no sword's been drawn. Like, there's no lie. Like, it is just boom.
Done.
Here you go.
Wow. I wish that this were a more somber or maybe a scary story, because this ambiance, like, people listening on headphones are going to be loving.
Wait, it's building. We're going to get there.
Yeah.
You thought the story was good up to now. She's only 28. She's got
80 years.
Just 60 more years to thunder be a and lightning, badass
very, very
bitch.
Frightening.
Okay. Do you want to do the rest?
No, that was all I wanted to do, because it's thundering outside. Nothing's plugged into the wall. We're perfectly safe.
Until we're dead. With the wrath of the 12th century kings of England. Okay.
Furies.
So, Eleanor thinks, like, hey, it's all about to be great. Let me get my hands on a new kingdom. But she hasn't met her new mother-in-law, Matilda.
Adelaide and Matilda, seriously?
Yep.
Like, that's straight out of...
Two good names for cats there.
Great.
Okay.
Great names for cats.
So, Matilda, a few years ago, has tried to claim power in her own right over England. She is the daughter of a king. That king made her heiress to England, and there's been a whole fucking civil war about it in England for 40 years. But she doesn't end up ruling in her own right, but she guarantees the right of her son, Henry II, to rule. So now she has not only replaced mother of the king and consort, because Henry II wasn't married. Now she's giving up consort title, and she's not happy about it.
Gotcha.
She hasn't quite claimed the throne, but that throne is hers, and she's just shuffling shit around for her kid, or so she thinks. And now Matilda is going to be the queen, and no one needs to pay any attention at all to Eleanor. But Eleanor is paying attention to her other job as a queen. Having babies, right? She does her duty.
Right.
8 kids, 15 years. Lots of sons, daughters too. Eleanor has now been married to 2 kings of Europe, She is going to birth 3 kings of England and 2 daughters that will be queens in Europe as well. Her grandchildren are going to rule Europe for a long time coming, but let's just real quick make Louis the VII a little angrier because he only had 2 daughters.
Right, right.
Ha ha. For Henry II, she has 5 kids in rapid succession, like 5 kids, 6 years. This is Irish twins on
steroids. Yeah.
William, Henry, Matilda, Richard, Geoffrey. The next 9 years will bring 3 more children, Eleanor, Joanna, and her final son, John. So, childbearing and keeping up with kids kind of keeps her busy. And old Matilda is fine with that. Like, I got you, boo. That's fine.
I can sit in on
she's still,
meetings of the Privy Council.
Yeah, not releasing any power to Eleanor as like queen in her own right.
Right.
But Eleanor does her job and she has babies and presents at court because that's how you do your rep.
Well, and this was actually a marriage for love-ish, right? As opposed to her marriage to Louis. Like, I feel like there was...
Can I say that maybe it changes? Why can't it be both?
Well, there's certainly... None of these people can do anything that don't involve the politics. None of the men can do anything that don't involve the politics of their kingdoms.
That's right?
But it sounds like... It sounds like she and Henry hit it off when he was over in Paris negotiating.
I don't know. I think it shifts over time and it's both. Wait till you hear the end of the story.
Okay.
So Eleanor not being handed any power, but she rolls along. Things go, you know, having babies and taking care of shit, appearing at court, till about 1167. So Eleanor's in her early 40s, and her child-rearing age has passed, and Henry II is a notorious fucking adulterer.
Sure.
So he's like, all right, hey, Eleanor, I know you've been itching. I know you've been wanting some power for a little while. How about you head on back down to Aquitaine, and you can rule in my name and get you out of the way.
Wait, literally, like, let's just get separate houses, dear.
Yeah, kind of. Why don't you go back to your homeland? I know you miss it. I know you really like it. And there's some shit brewing over there, and I trust you're, you know, fine. And your job for me here is totally done. So why don't you go back home, have 2 separate houses, and you just do your thing down there and keep my shit handled.
Mead is a very different beverage than you know, wine from grapes. So she probably did miss home.
Do you want to open a bottle? Kinda.
We could. I took him out of the fridge. Because it seemed like we weren't going to... So they're not cold, but...
Never mind. Cold means better.
Be better. Okay. We have champagne.
Do you want to pour a drink?
From France.
So things rock and roll on to about 1167.
Okay.
Eleanor's in her early 40s. And Henry sends her to govern Aquitaine in his name.
Okay.
Like, she can't have any more kids.
Okay, so she's, all right, she's aged out of childbearing.
Aged out? Henry II is a notorious adulterer.
They all were, right?
And, well, he's got mistresses,
were there
right?
any kings that we think were faithful?
I will go on that quest. There's like one.
Okay, yeah.
It's not a trope. Let's put it that way. Okay. So Henry II is a notorious adulterer, and he wants to get her out of the way. And remember, it's perfectly fine for women to hold power as long as it is in the name of their husband the name of their son.
Sure.
That's what history has proven us to 1167. Right.
Well, and that's what Matilda is clinging on to
now.
In the name of her son, she is wielding a lot of power.
That's it. So Eleanor makes a triumphant return to Aquitaine. And this is the land of her people. And she's back in a high fancy court. And she's in charge, and there are troubadours and chivalry in all the best of ways. And she is running the country like a badass. She's building up her own power base. Remember her move.
Is her uncle still alive? Do you know?
Yeah. Yes-ish.
Okay.
And he's still going to be an ally for a minute, but he's not coming back into the narrative,
okay.
I'm telling.
Okay.
I like it that you root for supporting characters. I will give you a follow-up offline for him.
I mean, again, like, so this territory is now controlled by England. And so even if this guy has been ruling that territory, as soon as the Queen of England arrives, like, it's hers, right? So, and that way she would be unseating. It's just the whole thing.
But what on earth would make you think that she's the story? She has 5 sons. Oh.
Are they not in London? Are they not in oldie London town?
They're all over the place and all the land that she... Wait for it.
Wait.
I hope, dear esteemed listener, that Stacey is really stepping in for you on this and acting as your representative, and you are just as
well. I'm genuinely
awestruck.
I mean, like, she is empowered by the king, her husband, to rule in his stead. Like,
that's it.
In his name, not his stead. His name.
His name. Okay. She does this, and this next little bit I'm going to tell you about is one of the most recorded incidents and stories of the 12th century in literature.
It's when she launches her own winery?
No.
Eleanor?
This is when Henry II starts an affair with Rosalind Clifford. Rosalind. Apparently, she's the most beautiful woman in Europe. Like, all kings have affairs, but this is different. Henry is head over heels in love, and for as much as we don't know about Eleanor, Rosalind is described as the antithesis of Eleanor. She is, these are the words, she is exactly the opposite of everything Eleanor is. She is soft and kind and feminine.
Oh, interesting.
There's a whole line of subjecture there. Conjecture.
Conjecture.
Subjective conjecture. Ha ha. No, there that we could go into. Anyway, Henry and Miss Clifford conduct an affair for a long time. So, she's everything my current wife isn't, and Eleanor finds out, and she is really pissed. And there are a lot of recorded versions about what could have happened. There's one where Eleanor storms off to confront Rosamond at Woodstock, who runs out in the garden maze, but her dress gets caught and Eleanor catches her. And she's like, listen, bitch, you can choose. Do you want to die by poison or dagger to the heart? And Rosamond in legend chooses poison. Or there's another legend, like maybe she was dragged into the court under Eleanor's orders and like mocked. Regardless, she flees to a nunnery and dies kind of a sad life, but she fascinates writers for centuries.
Are you serious?
Yes. Eleanor's about power and ambition.
Sure.
And maybe she's just tired of not being able to use her political brain, so she is happy to get on back to Aquitaine and do her shit. No fear. In this time, she ends up getting... So the first son, William, has died, is like a child.
Okay.
Because it's just very, a risk to
maybe common. Yeah, very common at the time.
I mean, I don't mean to be callous, but that's...
They didn't have vaccines and they didn't have soap. Like, let's...
Be honest about it.
The deck was stacked against them. Seriously.
So she has gotten her next eldest son, who we're going to call Henry the Young, just to keep him unconfused with Henry II.
Did you say Henny Youngman?
Henny Youngman. Henny the Youngman. Yes. So he gets crowned as heir.
Okay,
to England. But she has these 3 other sons who are growing up and are like, hey, why do we have to wait for power? Like, these plans that Dad has for us, Mom, are pretty cool with, like, the power and lands and titles we're going to get in the future, but it'd be really cool to rule something now in the meantime.
So, if we could get our inheritances before you die, that would be great.
It's wait for it. So these sons are the male heirs of so much of Europe, and they are for sure Eleanor's biggest asset. And her husband, Henry, is never going to give up power willingly. So she's like, all right, I think I'm going to kind of back you. And there's some power plays where her son Richard tries to make some plays, and Jeffrey's making some plays, and doesn't go great for any of the boys or for her. The sons fail in their power bid.
Like, they're not warring against their father, are
yeah.
they?
Yeah.
Oh, they are. Oh,
fuck yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You needed to clarify that. So they launch their own little civil wars because
yeah, yeah.
this is, I mean, this is how power transferred in England a lot.
Well, until, like, they had been promised lands, but they start to actively begin fighting for the lands that they
yeah.
were promised.
Oh, I'm sure. Like, they get to young adulthood and, like, what the fuck am I doing cooling my heels in your
exactly
court,
right.
dad? Like,
and Henry II's like, nah, son, I don't think so. We're going to pull you back.
Yikes.
And
you can't have Scotland till you're 25.
Well, these are territories in France. These
okay.
are little duchies.
Okay.
These are,
okay.
you know.
They want to open wineries. Henry.
I want to joust for real. Okay. So in 1173, Eleanor flees
so
out of
Aqu- 50 now.
Yeah.
Okay.
But she flees because Henry II's coming for her and the kids. And she hightails it back on up because she's going to go hide out with her ex-husband, Louis VII, for a while.
What?
Yeah. Well, because he definitely wants to help her hand over her lands to her sons and get them the fuck out of the hands of England. Right?
Okay.
Of course. Come up here. I'll give you shelter.
This is so bizarre.
So let's lay down some facts.
This is so bizarre.
This is the late 12th century.
I guess this is the advantage of staying friends with your exes.
I actually have that written. Friends with all my exes. So, I mean, if you need shelter, there's a reason you broke up. We are never getting back together.
Sure.
There's a reason why you loved him, and we can be civil and friends. Okay. So let's lay down some facts. Late 12th century. So many of these themes we are going to see over and over and over coming up through the Trashy Tudor ride, but here we really do have a first of its kind. Eleanor, the first of her name. She's already pulled some magnificent plans before, but this is a little too over the top. So up to this date in history, there have been about 30 cases of how sons go against a father king in rebellion. It's a common trope. This is the first time in history a wife has openly rebelled against her husband. She is vilified. She is written about. It is recorded that she is a threat to the very fabric of society. She will be the cause of its general ruin.
Rolling my eyes.
And she's like, y'all can fuck right off because these are my kids and we're going to do this. So she rides north to participate in battle and or flee like it all happens. And she's captured disguised as a man in the fall of 1174. Her sons are also captured. And Henry II treats the kids much kinder. He ends up kind of settling,
yeah, they're his
patting
kids.
Their heads,
yeah.
But not Eleanor. She is going to spend the next 15 years locked up in confinement. She is a 12th century Shelley Miscavige.
Or a 12th century political prisoner.
No, she's a political prisoner. She gets blamed for all the civil wars that have happened because even though she's locked up, it's the guys who can't stop fighting.
Right.
So even over the next 15 years, these sons are still going to make a play scot-free from blame because Eleanor, who's sitting in a fucking jail, is getting all the blame for it.
Was she? Because my understanding is
she was.
Really? Because
yeah.
Because I feel like often when nobles were imprisoned, especially for political reasons, there was still a household staff. They were at a nice country house. They just couldn't leave. And if there was any hint that they were participating in, you know, fueling the rebellion or whatever, then they could perhaps be killed. But
I mean, she was lucky not to have been killed,
yeah.
But he couldn't really kill her, so he just locked her up.
Has he met Henry VIII?
Right. She's kept, like, we don't even know where she was kept. It was that
oh, wow.
hidden
okay.
for 10 years. Like, we don't know what the hell happened in those 10 years. But after 10 years, I guess she's under control enough or broken enough or placated her captors long enough for Henry to bring her out occasionally. Like, not often, but she'll come to court if he has a political advantage to make out of it. He'd take her out, dust her off, and prop her up if, like, a few of his kids are going to be there that he needs to calm the waters between.
That is so bizarre. I mean, I know it's crazy. Divorce was not a thing at the time.
Okay, so let's take a little time hop back and talk about the West Wing. Because, I mean, the West Wing. Jed Bartlett's favorite film, referred to in the West Wing, is actually about our fair heroine, Eleanor of Aquitaine, in today's tale, The Lion in Winter. It's all about the events that are going to come next. Highly recommend you watch the movie. Super good movie. I'm going to give you the movie's description from the web. It's Christmas, 1183, and Henry II is planning to announce his successor to the throne. The jockeying for the crown, though, is complex. Henry has three sons and wants his boy, Prince John, to take over. Henry's wife, Queen Eleanor, who is played by Katharine Hepburn, has other ideas. She believes their son Richard should be king. As the family and various schemers gather for the holiday, each tries to make the indecisive king choose their option. Released in 1968, starring Peter O'Toole, I mean, Katharine Hepburn. I'll throw a clip of Jed Bartlett talking about Lion in Winter. It's a good movie if you need a visual narrative to round this out. Henry II does die in July of 1189. And because Henry the Young has also died.
Okay.
So Richard actually is heir presumptive.
Right.
Richard, who becomes Richard the Lionheart, once he verifies that Daddy-O is really dead, he sends word immediately to release his mother, and she has control of the kingdom, and you are to do whatever the fuck she says. She is Beyonce now. She is Queen E. She is in charge. She is 65 years old.
Good boy.
And ruling England as a dowager queen, as well as a consort, because right now Richard isn't married. But he's about to be, because she's going to arrange that and become that mother-in-law. So there's some bullshit that happens with her baby son, spoiled John, and that shit goes pretty bad for a while, but he's the favorite, and she gets it under control and marries Richard off. He's secured his succession because now that he's married, and he decides to go on crusade because it didn't go, because it went so great for her and her first husband.
Yeah, yeah.
But now Eleanor really is in charge. She's the queen of England. Richard is, there's no communique. Like, there's no.
Yeah, he's off in the Holy Land. What he we do. May come back, he may not.
Eleanor's queen of England. And she's killing it. Like, she's doing what she needs to do. And he goes on crusades, which sort of builds up his, you know, legendary reputation.
Oh, sure.
But he has a hard time getting back. And when he does, he ends up getting captured in Austria.
So that is a circuitous route.
Not only is she ruling England, but she has to raise the ransom funds to get him released and get him home. I'm going to have you take a sip. I'm going to take a sip, and then we're going to put our drinks down because I want you to know the impact of this number is staggering.
Okay. $1 million.
It's about it. Austria, the German-Austrian jail he's in, wants 100,000 marks. Which is a shit ton of money at the time. So I'm like, how much is that shit ton of money at the time? So in my currency converter that I found, I can only go back to 1264 as the base year.
That's really hilarious that it goes back that far.
Okay. If you're looking in today's dollars for that 100,000 marks in 2019, do you want to guess?
$50 billion.
Double that plus 10 million, 109 million smackaroos, scallions.
$109 million?
$109
million. Million or billion?
Million.
Okay.
What did you say?
I said 50 billion.
Oh, well then no. Get out of the intergalactic. No, $109 million.
It's been 800 years. I'm thinking, you know.
But 100,000 marks, like, I don't know.
Over 800 years. Yeah, I would guess billions, sure. You know what? No one cares about Austria's
currency. I
wrote
this story to impress you, but apparently,
okay, so
unimpressible.
$110 million. It's a good sum of money.
Which she raises and gets him bounced out alive, which is kind of a fucking miracle.
Yeah.
So in 1199, 10 years later, like Richard gets back, does a great job as king, until he's fatally wounded with an arrow. Eleanor then secures the line of succession for her next son, John. And so when she's like 75,
we're coming to the end of her.
Yep. Travels to support his reign. And if you would like the totally true story about Prince John, please watch 1973's Disney classic, Robin Hood. It will give you all you need to know about him, and we hate him. So after kicking all the power over to ensure John gains power, mm-hmm. eventually Eleanor returns to her homeland, spending the last few years of her life in silence. She dies at the age of 80 or 82, again, depending on birth year, on the 31st of March, 1204. She is laid to rest besides that ass face Henry II and two of her children after a long, feisty, and rebellious life. Outlived both husbands and all but two of her 10 children. Jeez. She's one of the most powerful figures in all of Europe, a 12th century badass.
Well, I realize many of the monarchies of Europe were swept away in the last century or so, but like, are her genes still running any countries in Europe?
Oh, I don't know. Probably. I mean, I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah.
You've got the current royal family related both on the mother's side and the father's side to Mary Boleyn, and she's just the sister of Anne. Like,
yeah.
He wasn't even in the royal, like, maybe. I wouldn't doubt it.
Yeah, interesting.
Okay, I gotta take a breath. That was fun.
Yeah. No, that's a really amazing...
It's the saga of Eleanor of Aquitaine.
An amazing feminist life in a time when...
The 12th century when women
couldn't
do that.
The scapegoating of her, like, that...
This
one woman's bad acts will... You know, ruin the world as we
know. Like, fabric of society.
Go fuck yourselves and invent democracy already. Like.
So, what's happening next on Trashy Tutors? Next episode, we're going to do something really fun because we're calling it Taking the High Road Over and Around the War of the Roses. This is going to be a little bit of a reference for everybody in a fun and not boring at all way. To skip through some of the bigger swatches of history that we're going to be doing, I want to make sure you have a solid backdrop so that when we do these deeper dives that are coming for you, you have a frame of reference in which to set these characters, so to speak. The spreadsheet lineup is lit, y'all. So stay tuned for War of the Roses overview. There will be another bonus, Trashy Tutors, this month, that deep dives into a little bit of that that's just fun that I think you'll like. Oh, and one other thing. The Trashy Divorces Easy Peasy Book Club starts in July. So here's where it's tutor adjacent. The Easy Peasy Book Club is a new benefit for our $10 and up patrons. And the deal with the EPBC is that books less than 200 pages. Nothing too hard or time-consuming, but the text will explore in some way what's happening within Trashy Divorces somewhere. Anyway, it's an easy book club for lazy and smart people, which...
Yes.
Represent.
Busy. Let's say busy people.
For busy and smart people. There you go. See? This is why we're better together. So, this month's book, Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay, is actually a little amazing mystery,
really is.
Which delves into the princes in the tower, which will connect into that War of the Roses thing. So if you're interested in that true crime adjacent thing, check out The Daughter of Time by Josephine Tay. Happy to talk about it. Consider joining our little book club too. It's going to be fun. That, my dear, is the 12th century badass. The bitch is back.
That is an exceptional life.
Eleanor of Aquitaine.
And now I would like to read a book or maybe watch The Lion in Winter or something.
Maybe we add that to our break this week, Lion in Winter. Okay. I haven't seen it in a long time.
I don't know if I ever have.
Jed Bartlett loves it.
Sure.
Kay Hepburn, you can't go wrong with her.
I mean, it's hard to see that there has not been a more modern film take on her. Like, again, that's an extraordinarily sort of feminist life at a time when... Certainly it predated feminism.
Well, it was tampered down a lot. We're not talking about that. I mean, she's got the woman who predates her, Matilda, is kind of the baddest ass until then, at least in the first century.
Yeah, no, I read her Wikipedia entry a while back, and I agree.
Matilda's a badass.
Extraordinary. Yeah.
Shitty mother-in-law, but big badass.
Well,
I don't know. It only gets more exciting from here, but in this story, we've laid all these threads that are going to continue to come up in a way that, again, we're never going to see an annulment that good.
Yeah.
That is the last time in history that's going to happen. But Sun's making power plays, and how does it shift? And land grabs. There's a Princess Bride quote about land grabs, right?
Never engage in a land war in Asia.
Close enough. Or England or France.
I think I just burped into the microphone.
Let's drink some wine. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
For tuning in and being our patrons. And thank you, everyone, for this crazy suggestion. Mm-hmm. I had an idea about Eleanor, but I didn't know that she was that much of a badass.
That's a cool story, though.
Thanks for leading me down that rabbit hole.
Married to the King of France and then to the King of England. Like, how unlikely is that? But there it is.
80 years. Killing it.
Killing it.
I hope you liked it.
Right.
We need to learn how to end a show.
We'll have more soon.
Keep it medieval.
Lock up your mother-in-law for 15 years now. Should probably cut that. Back soon.
Here's you guys.
Keep it trashy.
Talk to you soon.
You're probably familiar with the idea of self-care, but where do you find the time? With Care Of, it's simple. You take a quick lifestyle quiz, and then every month you receive a supply of vitamins and supplements in customized daily use packaging. The packets are really cool too. Each one is different, but mine all begin with, "Hi, Stacy," and then include a fact for the day, like everyone has a unique tongue print. I did not know that.
The fun facts are fun, but you have a monogrammed packet every day.
It's a little bit like it's monogrammed, yes.
Our friends at Care Of make it super easy to prioritize your own health and wellness. It's simple to upgrade your health routine. Whether you need more energy or better sleep, help managing stress, or just the peace of mind that goes with doing something good for your body, Care Of can help. And because your order is based on your specific quiz responses, you'll get just what you need.
And not all that extra stuff.
That's it.
Yeah, more importantly, Care Of is totally transparent in their sourcing. Like, they source magnesium from Irish seawater and calcium from Icelandic algae. And they've got a ton of research available on their website. You can be confident that you're putting only the highest quality ingredients into your body to support your personal health goals.
And the quiz really is quick and easy and kind of fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
You'll select a few areas that you personally want to focus on. Maybe stress, skin, brain, hair, sleep, bones, maybe everything. It'll ask a few questions on what your priorities are in kind of an easy and fun way. The thing I really liked about the quiz is it wanted to know about your level of comfortability. So you take all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
I'm not. So it was sort of interesting the way it really is such a specific catered solution.
Right, right.
For you.
Not cookie cutter at all. Yeah, we got very different recommendations
totally
at the end.
Totally different.
And you can customize them from there. When it comes to vitamins and supplements, I am a spirit is willing, but the flesh is forgetful kind of person. So the daily dose packaging is really good for me because I really do have drawers. I mean, you know this. I've got drawers full of vitamin bottles from the grocery store. And once they're out of sight, they are out of mind and they don't get taken every day. So Care Of puts it all together as part of my daily routine. I can just pop it open after breakfast, or I can take it with me where I'm going and have vitamins throughout the day. These are high quality vitamins, minerals, herbs, probiotics, and supplements in a very thoughtfully put together selection.
You want your own self-care delivery? We got you. To get 25% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the code TRASHY.
That is 25% off your first order by visiting takecareof.com and entering TRASHY.
You might be surprised to learn that the government actually doesn't require manufacturers of feminine care products to disclose all the stuff they put into them.
Shocker.
I know, right? That means you may be exposing yourself to synthetic materials, harsh chemical cleansing agents, fragrances, dyes, all without ever knowing.
Yeah, Lola does not do business that way. They know that their customers care, so they offer complete transparency about the ingredients used to make their tampons, pads, liners, and wipes. Lola products are made from 100% organic cotton and have zero added chemicals, fragrances, synthetics, or dyes.
Ultra high quality, made with care, feminine hygiene, conveniently and discreetly delivered to you monthly through Lola's flexible, customizable subscription. You choose your mix of products, absorbency, how many boxes, how often you'll receive them. Lola does all the rest. It is a company founded by women for women. They really get it.
Yeah, I am excited because my days of rushing to the grocery store for pads or tampons, all emotional and crampy, are over.
Emergency period!
No kidding. God. Of all of the things that are worth handling with a monthly delivery, it's hard to think of a better product than period supplies. And now, Lola offers biodegradable, all-natural cleansing wipes that are safe for use anywhere on the body, hypoallergenic, and gynecologist approved. Even better, for every purchase, Lola donates products to homeless shelters across the U.S., which is awesome.
I love that. Mm-hmm. Y'all, best of all, we got a promo code for you.
Woo!
For 40% off your first month subscription, visit mylola.com and enter trashy when you subscribe.
Never race to the store at 2 a.m. because you didn't realize you were about to start again. Visit mylola.com and enter trashy when you subscribe to get 40% off your first order.
Cheerio, Stacy.
Cheerio.
Good day, ma'am.
Good day, mate.
Welcome to... No. Trashy Tidbits for Thursday, May 30th.
It's my birthday!
It is your birthday. Happy birthday, Stacey.
Thank you. I got you a present.
You did get me a present. We got all of you a present for Stacey's birthday. How many more days to the beach? Let's just give a countdown so everybody knows.
Fixing up my kayak to go to the beach. Okay. Gotta do some fishing when I get to the beach.
And you guys thought I sang a lot. Okay, so this week you have prepared for us a really special story. In my research on Princess Margaret, I came across this just long line of research that I didn't have time to fit in, and naked pictures and a bank robbery and MI5. And I'm like, damn, I want to know more about this. And tossed that thread over to you, and
you pulled
that thread.
It got weird as fuck is what happened.
Talk to me.
So this thing, basically, this starts as the story of the Baker Street robbery, which was a 1971 bank heist in London. But it was a very unusual bank heist that has become sort of a story of legend.
It's kind of legendary.
Yeah, there's a bunch of myth-making, or maybe not, I don't know. But there are all these like stories and...
So the Baker Street burglary.
The Baker Street robbery, yeah.
Oh, okay.
But I realized, because there is this allegation that somehow this is like an MI5 plot, or that MI5, the British Intelligence Services, MI5, that somehow it was a plot by them or a cover-up by them after the fact. And you know me, normally I hear conspiracy theories and I roll my eyes and I think, okay, whatever. Like, why would MI5?
No, you came and asked for my phone.
Holy shit, did this go in a direction.
Tinfoil hat. Let's do this.
Let's do this.
Do I need to get out my tinfoil hat?
Well, okay. Well, let me start by saying that the robbery occurred the night of Saturday, September 11th, 1971. I'm pretty sure if you're a QAnon person and you hear September 11, you already know that this is part of a global conspiracy of something.
Done.
So probably
do we have a basement of
probably Donald Trump is going to solve the Baker Street robbery.
Do we have a sex ring basement?
We might. In fact,
let me get out my trashy
dude. This gets
divorces
so weird.
Bingo card.
This gets a little upsetting, even. Okay, so September 11, 1971. It's a Saturday. A group of Londoners overnight are engaged in a sort of surprising project. 3 months earlier, they had leased a leather goods shop on Baker Street, which is in central London. It's really close to that mews where Stephen Ward lived.
Okay.
Right around there. Okay, so they had leased this leather goods shop on Baker Street. Then they spent the ensuing three-month period tunneling down, presumably in the back of the store, down through the floor, and then south beneath the Chicken Inn restaurant until they arrived at the exterior wall of the vault of the Baker Street branch of Lloyds Bank of London.
Oh my God.
Initially, they tried to cut through the wall using a tool called a thermal lance, which I had to Google, and it's pretty much what it sounds like. It's a rod that
hot
heats
stick.
Up. It'll bore through steel.
Oh my God.
It's a hot stick.
Is that a thermal lance in your pocket, or are you just happy to see me?
It is a hot stick that will bore through steel. But that didn't work for them. And, they just had to use some explosives to knock through the wall into the vault of Lloyds Bank on Baker Street in the middle of the night.
No bigs.
In oldie London town.
School, did anybody hear that?
Apparently not.
Well, it was so far underground?
I guess that's all I can guess. Maybe okay. Maybe at the time, maybe it's like in a commercial district, so there weren't really residential. I don't know. Deserted area. I don't know.
So this is all vaguely reminiscent. I know where the robbers got this idea. This is the gunpowder plot with Guy Fawkes. They ended up renting out a space underneath Parliament, just a general storehouse where right. they're putting in all of their
sure.
explosive shit. Like it's, there's right. a similar repetition. Go
Interesting.
Ahead. But nobody, how far underground?
I'm not sure.
Like enough to not be heard.
Enough to not be heard.
Wow. Okay.
Also, there's some weird stuff here. One, these are all like two-bit criminals.
Okay.
These are not criminal masterminds. So it was very confusing to police when they learned that, for instance, the group was using walkie-talkies to communicate, which it was sort of a newer technology and I think technically not legal in the UK at the time.
Okay.
I'm sure the police could have them, military, all that. But anyway, they had a guy on the roof acting as a lookout, unknown to them, nearby on Wimpole Street, a ham radio operator named Robert Rowlands. He was messing around with his ham radio and inadvertently accesses their channel around 11.
I fucking love accidents in history.
Yeah.
They're like, my favorite thing.
11:15 p.m. He's hearing this bank robbery
happen.
Going down.
Mm-hmm.
He calls the police and they're like,
what are you talking about, dude?
They completely blow him off. They're like,
You have a what kind of communication channel to the aliens?
How about you just record that for us? And, you know, we'll get back to you if
we... Oh, my God, they blow them off.
Blow them off.
Oh, my God.
So around 1 a.m., this thing is still going on. And perhaps around 1 a.m. is when the explosives happen. I'm thinking because he calls Scotland Yard. He's like...
The ham radio operator.
Yeah, Rowlands. He's like, holy shit. So he calls Scotland Yard, which promptly dispatches officers to his home. And at 2 a.m., radio detector vans are sent out to try to, like, triangulate.
Pinpoint.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an episode of 24.
And...
Dink.
And, like, I guess the Met, is that what the London police are called?
Metropolitan Police. Mm-hmm.
So I guess they order the Met to do a bank-to-bank search covering a 10-square-mile area trying to find these robbers, which was overkill because Rowlands kept saying, look.
They're right
this,
here.
Yeah, this technology, like, they're within a mile of me. I know it. And they were, for sure. So they ended up searching, I don't know, 750 banks that night.
Jesus Christ.
They did search Lloyd's on Baker Street, and they went down to the door to the vault, and the door was closed and completely intact, and everything was secure. Nothing was amiss.
But they didn't come in from the front. They came in from the back.
Right.
So they never would have known.
The thieves were on the other side of the 15-inch thick door.
Right there
when
they came in.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God.
So they left without opening it. Meanwhile, on the other side of that door, the thieves were using crowbars to pry open more than 260 safety deposit boxes
Whoa.
Belonging to some of the UK's upper crust. Okay, so the haul that they made off with is thought to be worth about £40 million in today's pounds. I wrote today's dollars, but obviously that's dumb.
I mean, are they looking for jewels, money, stocks, bonds?
Which, theoretically, they found all of.
Cash. 60. Let me ask you, I don't know if you know this, so we can cut it, but how did the gang of cut-rate robbers, do you know, get clued into this is the place to go? Is that coming up?
No, because, I mean, it's all, there's no explanation. There's no explanation that's ever been given by them, but like they all
Tight-lipped.
Went to, they got caught, they went to jail for a few years, they got out. No money was ever recovered. Nothing was ever recovered from this crime.
Huh.
They took off with, they think, £40 million worth of
stuff,
plus all kinds of documents. I mean, people store birth certificates in safe deposit boxes. They, you know, they store all kinds of things, jewels,
wow.
tiaras. Anyway, in truth, the extent of their haul is not known because the contents of the safety deposit boxes were obviously private to their owners.
And never been found.
Well, and apparently many of those owners never came forward to report what they had been stolen, what had been stolen from them. The thieves, just as a final twist, I don't know, they wrote on the wall of the vault before they left, let's see how Sherlock Holmes solves this one.
Ha! It's beautiful.
Okay. So It's really, okay, so the robbery itself has become the stuff of legend because of its sheer audacity. The men involved were small-time crooks with marginal day jobs and no history indicating that such a complex, well-planned, and lengthy, I mean, this took months to put into practice.
Sure.
This lengthy heist was something that they could accomplish. Police wondered where they'd found the money for a thermal lance or how they'd managed to procure radios and explosives.
Yeah,
and
hot sticks ain't cheap.
More importantly, who had masterminded this? The man who leased the leather goods shop, he's either Desmond Wolfe or Benjamin Wolfe, I've seen in both, used his real name when he signed the lease for the leather shop. So, you know, the next day the police are like, knock, knock, do you have the lease on the leather shop on Baker Street? And he's like, of course I do. And so he's arrested.
Oh my God.
But not exactly a mastermind of anything, nor were the other guys, Anthony Gavin, Thomas Stevens, and Reginald Tucker. The last three pleaded guilty, were sentenced to 12 years. Two of them got it knocked down to 8. Wolf pleaded not guilty. He got 8. There were a couple of other people tried for like handling banknotes from it. But again, the police never recovered any banknotes from it, so they were acquitted.
So those seem like awfully lenient sentences for a crime of that magnitude, not having recovered any of those assets.
I think that the criminal justice system in the UK is less punitive than ours and was at the time, too. Although I think when you go back a little bit further, you've just got bobbies beating the shit out of people with nightsticks. So
it wouldn't have anything to do with MI5 coming in and shutting the whole thing fucking down. Like, we'll give you a lighter sentence.
That is a supposition, certainly. So yeah, nothing from the crime was ever recovered by police. Once released, the robbers lived quiet, but apparently very comfortable lives. They appeared to have quite a bit of money, it is said. Only one purported member of the gang has ever spoken publicly about it, a man named Brian Reeder. And again, he wasn't prosecuted at the time, so it's possible he's just bullshitting here and wasn't part of it at all. But he says that he was part of the crew and that when they were down there, they found pictures in the vault of prominent political figures sexually abusing children. And he says that they made sure to scatter those pictures all over the floor so that the police could not miss them. The police could not pretend they had not seen photographs of prominent British political figures molesting children.
So these are like good guy robbers. If they find shit, they're not taking it to take it and blackmail it. They're leaving it littered on the floor?
This is one potential
story.
Okay. And so, yeah, this is a fine jumping off point to talk about the theories that have evolved around the Baker Street robbery. So most of these theories hinge on what they hit compared to what they could have hit. Presumably there's a vault full of cash as well in the building. That's okay. Not what they went to.
Oh.
Right. They did a pretty elaborate entry and presumably could have entered a different room if they wanted to.
I mean, like, how do you know which vault to go to when you break into Gringotts?
It's a question.
Right?
The robbers didn't appear to be interested in cash, but in secrets, the types of documents one might file away in a bank vault, the types of valuables one might tuck there. There's a 2008 movie starring Jason Statham, whatever. It's called the Bank Job.
Oh, okay.
Some actor. Dude.
Bank Job is one of my very favorite songs by Bare Naked Ladies.
There you go.
Okay,
so the Bank Job, for instance, gives us the theory that MI5, Britain's famed intelligence service, hired the gang and put the plan together in order to retrieve pornographic pictures of Princess Margaret.
Oh.
Perhaps in a compromising position with one of several underworld figures she was known to entertain at her Caribbean island compound on Mystique, which I think she named Port Debauchery, but you have a weird pronunciation for it.
La Jolizo.
Yeah, I think you're saying it wrong. I think it's called Port Debauchery.
I thought it was called Princess Cougar Sex Island Party House.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
Princess Cougar Sex Compound. Okay, I would call it one of those things anyway. So the theory is that these pictures would be damaging to the royal family or worse, like could, you know, I think there's always a tension.
Do you remember when people had shame once upon a time? It was so long ago. Go ahead.
I'm ashamed at how long ago it was. Okay, it could be damaging to the royal family or who knows, could be worse in some way. And MI5 wanted these pictures out of the vault so that they could not be used as blackmail material. The idea here is that over the years, the eclectic circle that Margaret entertained included some sketchier figures, like this actor slash bodyguard slash gangster named John Dennis Bindon, with whom she allegedly had an affair, and it seems like her biographer believes the affair happened. Bindon bragged about it.
Oh, they're so photographed. They had a great time mm-hmm. on Mustique. Mm-hmm. He caused many, many problems for her. Mm-hmm. And you're going to talk about his nickname, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay, so Bindon was acquainted with Christine Keeler of Profumo Affair fame. He seems to have visited Mustique at least twice, once in 67 or 68 after his acting debut, and then again after 68 when he went with his girlfriend, socialite Vicky Hodge.
Which is how he met Princess Margaret at a luncheon. But
he'd already been to Mustique.
Sure, but he met Princess Margaret at this. I did some research on this. Okay. And apparently, if we're going to talk about Margaret being annoying AF, apparently John Bender is the funniest person that has ever walked the face of the planet.
Interesting.
All of his friends are like, you had to walk away from him just to catch your breath. He was just debaucherous and kind of a rowdy sense of humor, a very rakish sense of humor. He'd really walk on the edge. And for some reason, Princess Margie was like very much like a man's man.
Yeah, that seemed clear from the pictures.
And there was something in the way that he was able to skirt the line of inappropriate with Princess Margaret that she really dug. Like, they instantly sort of fell for each other, and he was apparently just a fucking rogue and was as inappropriate as can be, and she delighted in it.
Yeah, I mean, in reality, like, her husband Tony was an incredibly transgressive figure when they met.
Sure.
So she may just be into that.
Yeah. I mean, but he clearly stepped over protocol all the time with her, and she didn't seem to mind, and there may have been a reason.
Right. Well, let's talk about one of his cool party tricks that apparently would
attributes.
Delight the fuck out of her. So this dude was known as Five Pint John. Not because he could pack away the beer, although I'm sure he could pack away the beer, but because his favorite party trick was hanging 5-pint glasses off of his allegedly enormous dick. She apparently loved it. He was also known as Big John for the same reason, but I feel like that doesn't really capture the zest here.
No, 5 pints.
5 pints. Back to the theory. The theory is that underworld figure Michael X, real name Michael DeFrate,
okay,
a Londoner engaged in all manner of misconduct, drugs, slumlording, somehow gets his hands on compromising pictures of Margaret from Mustique.
Ooh.
These were, the story goes, his insurance policy against being prosecuted in England for his various gangster activities.
Right.
In 1971, shortly after the Baker Street robbery, DeFrate left England for his native Trinidad, where he ultimately was hanged for murder in 75.
Yikes.
But apparently he was supposed to be prosecuted in England for extortion in 71, but they just let him leave.
Let him go? Okay.
Robbery was over. It's interesting.
I mean, if you've got compromising material, they're probably going to let you the fuck out of the country.
Well, once they've gotten the compromising material from you and you have nothing.
That's a really good trade.
So, yeah, I don't find this theory super compelling, except there is this one detail that really is. There is an MI5 file on DeFrate, on Michael X, this mm-hmm. guy. Supposedly, this file is classified until 2054.
Whoa.
Which will be 79 years after his death. So, like, think about it. Let's say he was cooperating something or another with MI5 or with mm-hmm. the police or something, and they wanted to make sure that, like, none of his family would ever be harmed by... If he left a pregnant wife or girlfriend, that kid would, like, be 78 years old at the time. Like, I think they're safe.
That's 100 years. I mean, that's 3 full generations of hopefully nobody ever come looking for this shit.
Yeah, it's really weird. It seems like an extremely long classification period.
No, yeah, you put 100 years of restriction on. I mean, that's the JFK files.
Yeah.
There's plenty of stuff that's still sitting there that won't be seen till whatever, 2035, 2054.
Yeah. I guess the idea is that maybe some underworld figure, Bindon, perhaps. Because Bindon really was also kind of a gangster and racketeer.
Oh,
a lot of that.
Not
there
kind
was a
of.
A lot of that going on.
totally a gangster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So perhaps Bendon somehow gets in trouble with Defrate, owes him money, something like that, gets shaken down and is like, okay, you know, can't pay that debt or whatever, but I do have these pictures that are probably more valuable than anything else I could.
Interesting.
I think that's the theory. And then Defrate puts them in his safe deposit box, which again, I don't know that he had one. I think there's a whole lot of supposition happening here.
Sure.
So another theory, which goes back to Brian Reeder's comments that they found evidence of prominent government or even royal figures engaged in child sex abuse. There are at least two ways to look at this if you're in the MI5 orchestrated the heist or the cover-up club. One is that MI5 could gain leverage over politicians with blackmail material that would not only end their career but put them in prison. So MI5 gets more powerful.
I mean, that's a pretty good theory.
Sure. Two, MI5 may have been dispatched to cover up evidence that could have destroyed the British government. And the reason I feel like this is more likely is because, in fact, that had already happened a few years earlier. So, first of all, the reason MI5 is implicated in all of this is that for a number of years, journalists have reported that they, after the robbery in 71, they received what is called a D notice from the British government, which is a request, not a legally binding order, but it's a request that you don't report on a particular event,
okay,
usually for national security reasons, but it could also be that they didn't want the robbers to know that the robbery had been discovered so the police,
sure,
could go round them up and they wouldn't scurry.
So when I think denotice, I can kind of think like delay. We're not saying don't publish,
yeah,
it, just don't publish it now, just,
yeah,
a delay.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay.
So it took like 36 hours for the first reports to come out, and I think by then everyone had been arrested. So, you know, mission accomplished.
Yeah, these are not masterminds.
Yeah. Reporting. Oh, so the Wikipedia page for the robbery says that there is no record of a D notice being issued during this time.
Oh.
But the journalists who covered it are like, no, there
totally was.
There was. So, you know, and that, I mean,
it's all very shady.
MI5 could erase the records, right? I mean, it's when you get into, this is why I struggle with conspiracy theories, because like, if MI5 has magical powers to make stuff go away, why do they need to rob a bank at all? Why don't they just go in and get the shit they want? Okay, moving on. Okay, so when I started digging into like the misbehavior of British politicians, because I was thinking about the Comet Pizza thing, like Pizzagate here in the, mm-hmm, U.S., and just this sort of longstanding, because in Britain, there really is a longstanding thing that there is like an elite pedophilia ring.
Yes.
Like, I've heard of this my entire adult life. I mean, not heard, but I've heard rumblings of,
sure,
you know, that there is this view that the elites are so elite.
Engaged in some dirty, dirty deeds.
So I was thinking about
Jeffrey Epstein.
Yeah. And our labor secretary who gave him a sweetheart deal, which could have been totally proper based on, I don't know.
And
but
our president, and maybe Prince Andrew, and,
yeah,
now I forget,
Bill Clinton,
who I was, yeah, talking to you. In another tinfoil conspiracy hat, probably drunk conversation party, but whoever it was making the case like the world is run by pedophiles.
Yeah.
You just don't know it.
And you get glimpses of it, but let me tell you about one.
Okay.
So when I started digging into the misbehavior of British politicians, the extent to which the country's partisan media environment enables cover-ups is actually really shocking, and particularly in this time period. Perhaps even now, I don't know, but it is one thing for reporters to leave people alone about extramarital affairs between consenting adults, but it seems like the press there really will, or has in the past, covered up pedophilia rings if a paper's allegiance is to the party it's butting up against.
Catholic Church, yo.
There you go. That's true. There.
Catholic
perfect,
Church.
Perfect example. Okay, for our purposes, let's go back to Five Pint John Bendon, who starred opposite Mick Jagger in 1970's performance, and who was tied to mid-century London terrors, the Cray twins. These guys were,
mm-hmm,
like gangsters. So in the 1960s, they apparently spent much of their time when they weren't running their nightclubs and engaging in racketeering and shooting people to death,
like,
and stabbing people to death. And
it's a Tuesday, yo.
They were supplying young men, I do not know how young, to a politician from the Conservative Party by the name of Robert Lord Boothby, and a member of Parliament of the Labour Party named Tom Dryburg. One of the Cray twins was bisexual, so he was finding rent boys from all over East End.
I mean, if you'd have sent Philip a little mask, he probably would have done it for you for free.
Philip might have been there. But that's what I'm saying. Like, with Boothby, Boothby knew there were pictures. Mm. Like, Boothby ultimately was blackmailed. These guys did end up going to prison and basically dying in prison, but it took years because the government... Okay. Allegations about Boothby were known in, like, conservative media circles, but no one would publish because you don't want to... If your newspaper publisher is, you know, aligned with the conservative party, you're not going to take out a prominent conservative politician.
Sure, but now this dude's lined up with both sides of the fence.
Right. So that's, yeah, the craze, then, yeah, they cultivate... I think they actually got the Labor MP first, and through him ended up with Boothby in the mix.
So you're puppet master in everybody.
Yeah. Why not? Bipartisan support. But it really, it worked. Okay, in 1964, the year after the Profumo affair, the general election is a few months off, and conservatives were, of course, badly weakened by the Profumo affair. The Sunday Mirror, which is a labor mouthpiece, ran a piece insinuating a relationship between one of the Cray twins and Boothby. This was shut down by labor.
Whoa.
The Labor Party knew that this would sweep up their member of parliament, Tom Dryburgh, who was sort of high up in the party. They knew that he was gay. He ran with the Cray brothers and he ran with Boothby. And so, like, the Labor Party leaders go to this labor-aligned newspaper and they're like, make it stop, shut it down, end it. The paper publishes, like, a front-page apology to Boothby, fires the editor that published the article in the first place, even though he had a photograph and he had a report from Scotland Yard that it was true that Boothby was basically hooking up with rent boys all the time.
Crazy town.
Boothby sued, and the Mirror paid him £40,000.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Okay.
So this obviously forestalled other papers from bothering to investigate the Cray brothers, who really terrors. I mean...
Okay.
These guys, apparently somebody at some point told one of them, like, oh, looks like you put on some weight. And he, like, cut the guy to pieces.
Oh, my God.
Like, pulls out a knife and just goes to tell, like, these are terrible people. They're committing murder. They're busting people out of prison. They're committing armed robberies, arsons. They're running protection rackets. They're beating the shit out of people all the time. And they've got these nightclubs running where famous people, society people
Drugs,
are coming
liquor,
in.
Booze, Studio 54.
Yeah. Yeah. So they were able to cultivate their own protection. The police, finally in 1968, Scotland Yard would not help with the investigation of the Crays, by the way, on orders of the government. So it takes police years to shut these people down, but they go to jail in 68. So
hey, that's cray-cray.
That's cray-cray! But I mean, they go to jail in 68. The Boothby thing was in 64. Fleet Street knows that the Boothby thing is real. So yeah, like, that's the thing. Reporters, they can't say a lot of stuff because of the libel laws, again, but they all know it's true. 68, these two guys get swept up, finally removed from, you know, London town. But then in 71, you've got this mysterious heist with mysterious stuff going missing and all sorts of, like, oddities around when and how it can be reported and, like, who funded this and just all of these questions. And it's really not a surprise that that would become a source of real mythology. Anyway, that's the it's the Baker Street robbery.
That's a really, really good story, but I have on my tinfoil conspiracy hat.
When don't you?
All right. So my fashionable and functional tinfoil conspiracy hat.
Hit me with your
Here's
thoughts.
The addendum to that story.
Yeah.
The pictures on Mustique of Princess Margaret and Johnny Five Pints.
Sure.
Where he's wearing a Enjoy Cocaine
he
shirt.
Is. I saw the picture.
Come out like in the mid-70s. And here's my conspiracy connection spider web. I don't know how John Bender fits into this, but 1978, he was arrested and to be tried for...
Attempted murder,
I couldn't remember if it was attempted or murder. And... something shady happens that he's acquitted and let go.
Yeah.
And the supposition is, right?
Yeah.
He dangled Margaret on his little fishy hook.
Yeah. The Cray brothers got acquitted.
On his hot stick.
Ha ha. But yeah, apparently Boothby helped smooth something and got them acquitted in one trial before they were eventually nabbed. And then Boothby stood up and, I watched a documentary about this because I was up at 5 this morning. So they get arrested. And Boothby, who is being blackmailed by them because they've got a lot of pictures of him in a lot of compromising positions, gets up in Parliament or gets up in the House of Lords and basically says that the government needs to interfere in this trial and is shouted down because it is unconstitutional for the legislative branch to interfere in the judicial branch. It was very heartening to hear that once upon a time, everyone understood that the legislative branch should not interfere in the workings of the judicial branch.
No, I think this is a really good...
How far we have come.
Representation of our top lesson of trashy divorces is what is past is prologue. There's always historical precedent. There's nothing new under the sun. Don't rob banks, y'all.
I mean, or if you do, make sure that loot stays hidden for when you get out of jail.
What a mess. Thank you. That was a good...
You're welcome.
We unraveled that.
Yeah, I know that went in directions. But so if this had really come out in 64, again, it was Boothby. It was the conservative lord who was caught up in it. But after Profumo, also of the conservative party, it seemed like it would have... maybe ended the Conservative Party as a concern for a number of elections. But because the Liberals had their own... Again, dude, closets are terrible. Like, when people can live openly, then you don't have to play these games.
Yep.
And the libel laws make it tricky.
Can be held over your head.
Right.
You know what? You can never, like, call out everything bad I've done because I own it and I claim it and you can't hurt me with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That is some trashy, trashy Baker Street bank job nonsense, Stacey. Thank you.
I have no
for
idea.
For filling my head with all those conspiracy theories. I've got so much to think about now.
It seems reasonable to me that the Cray brothers may have handed off their blackmail material to somebody on the outside.
Oh, for sure.
Who may have stored it in that bank vault.
For fucking sure. Yeah.
That's really, that just seems more, because they're both in prison by then.
Yeah.
So that's what seems most likely to me, is that the Cray brothers had their shit in there.
Oh, give me a little while. I'll solve this one. You got a conspiracy. I'll solve it. Ice, ice, baby. Y'all have a great week. We'll talk to you next time
from the beach.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, we'll be at the beach on Sunday, but the episode will have been recorded prior.
Don't ruin the magic.
Magic! Bye.
Bye, y'all.
Trashy Divorces is written and produced by us, Stacey and Alicia, for Hemlock Creatives. You can contact us at trashydivorces@gmail.com. Our art is by Sydney V. Smith, and you can find more from her at sydneyvsmith@carbonmade.com. And our music is used with permission of Ratsy. You can find out more about Ratsy at Ratsy's store on Instagram.
Want to check out our sources, soundtracks, or other notable episode information? Visit trashydivorces.com. On the web, you can enjoy early ad-free releases, regular bonus stories, follow-ups, and more by joining us at patreon.com/trashydivorces.
We have merchandise available online too. Get your Trashy Divorces gear at bit.ly/trashymerch. And thanks to What a Maneuver for doing such a great job with our cloths.
Hey, we appreciate all of your ratings and reviews. If you do leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, send us a little picture of it. Let us know and we'll ship you some Trashy Divorces stickers and such. Anywhere in the world, we got you. Because holy cat, y'all, we're now in 125 countries
and counting.
Thank you for listening. Thank you for telling your friends. Thanks for being awesome. You can send those emails for your free sticker swag to trashydivorces@gmail.com.
And last but not least, check us out on social. We are at Trashy Divorces at Instagram, which Alicia mostly runs, Twitter, which I, Stacey, mostly run, and on Facebook, which we pretty much split. We also have a Trashy Divorces discussion group on Facebook if you want to chat with other Trashy Divorces listeners.
Thanks again, everybody, for listening.
Keep it trashy.